Compliance is a profession where people work tirelessly to make the world a better place. And there are hundreds of amazing and inspiring women who have helped the field develop into what it is today. Great Women in Compliance is part of the Compliance Podcast Network, so join Mary Shirley and Lisa Fine as they talk with women in compliance who are making a difference.
Welcome to the Great Woman in Compliance podcast with Lisa Fine and Mary Shirley. Thank you for joining us as we count down to our milestone 200. You can find us on the Compliance Podcast Network, run by Tom Fox, a big legend in compliance, amongst a treasure trove of other podcasts in the risk, ethics, and compliance spaces. We're sponsored by Corporate Compliance Insights, run by the very capable Sarah Haddon, where you can find the latest analysis and thought leadership in the field. Today's guest is Elaine Pretorius, who has recently joined McKinsey & Company from Molson Coors. Welcome, Elaine. Please tell us about yourself.
Oh, thank you, Mary. First off, so great joining you today. Real privilege. I think I've shared with you before, long-time listener, first-time caller, and so much enjoyed hearing some of the really remarkable GWICs that you've had on, and particularly their practical insights. Super excited to be here.
Thank you.
To start us off, I would say that I feel immensely lucky each day to have found my way into such a rewarding career and a field that's just evolving every single day. I can't think of anywhere where you can be one day looking at sort of data and analytics, next day behavioral science, tech, geopolitics, mixed in with sort of financial acumen and strategic acumen. It is a fascinating area to work in, and I love it. But I didn't start my career here. Probably as you can tell from my accent, I'm not originally from the US. I started my professional life as a lawyer in Scotland. So post-university, and candidly quite unsure of what I wanted to do with my life, I ended up joining a large firm in Edinburgh for my traineeship, which is a sort of a practical traineeship that you need to go through before becoming a qualified lawyer. And rather by chance, I secured a rotation at one of these sort of large full-service firms in Edinburgh, but working in their regulatory and competition law practice. And this team had served a number of multinational household names in the energy and the financial space. And I was totally fascinated by the work. It was so nuanced. And even with the same broad set of facts, you could end up with entirely different advice and answers. So loved it. Context really is king in that area. So upon completion of my training, for my sins, I moved to a large global firm in London and very quickly worked out that big law was really not for me.
Relatable.
I really wanted to get my hands dirty. I wanted to get to the practical application. And I give full credit to my dad's influence on this. He was a old school mechanical engineer in the Navy who was never happier than when he was trying to fix things with a piece of elastic or whatever he had to hand. So I've always really been interested in the sort of the practical application and the trial, the error, resourcefulness. So very early on, I decided to go in-house. My first role was with Unilever, a tremendous organization, but found myself working really full-time on sort of compliance matters and seeing the challenges and sort of inadvertent missteps in some of these businesses. I began to just really get curious and frankly frustrated around how to support a business and actually preventing these issues happening rather than being in the sort of the clear up squad, so to speak. So from there, and spurred really by a desire, personal desire to see more of the world, I took a number of roles with significantly larger geographical spans, found myself doing just more and more compliance work. So I was with a tech company supporting them in EMEA. So a lot of pre-acquisition due diligence, particularly around bribery and corruption, because there was a lot of startups which were offshoots of university incubators. And that got me to some very exciting parts of the world. And then took an opportunity at Diageo supporting what was then their Africa supply and procurement exec team. And again, it gave me some tremendous opportunities. I had some stints in Cameroon and Uganda.
Wow.
Really life-changing professional and life experiences. But Diageo had some well-publicized challenges, and just being exposed to that was really exciting. And made me realise this was really what I wanted to do. Rather unexpectedly, I got asked to help out on a sort of very short-term basis in Australia while they were working through some hiring challenges, and quickly went there for what was meant to be, I think, 8 to 12 weeks secondment. Fast forward 10 years, I found myself with an Australian husband and Australian children. But again, working for largely fast-moving consumer goods, CPG companies, Kellogg, Kimberly-Clark, and then ultimately moving to Molson Coors. And fascinating to gain that exposure and to use some of the knowledge that I gleaned in developing markets in Africa in the sort of Asia Pacific context. You know, a combination of luck and being, I think, at the right place at the right time. Molson Coors had had a global reorganization, and I was very excited to be offered the role to come and head up their global ethics and compliance team.
Wow.
So made the move to Milwaukee at the sort of end of 2019, beginning of 2020, and was there until January of this year, after which I joined McKinsey & Company, and now in Massachusetts supporting them from a geographic compliance standpoint. I feel incredibly lucky to have the really rewarding and great experiences, and love just being in this space.
I think timing is everything in life. And I think back to the inventor of Monopoly, the board game, and how she just happened to be at a ridiculous time in history for women to be acknowledged. And the credit went to a man instead, and she missed out on the riches and the recognition for that. And how many times in history has this happened? So timing, of course, is important, but I think you didn't capture just how much of that is from your own brilliance, your careful work, strategizing, planning, and just being really good at what you do. So I wanted to make sure that was acknowledged. And I love that you come from an antitrust background. That's how I came into the anti-corruption side of compliance as well. And it never ceases to amaze me how many of us came in through the door of having competition law backgrounds.
So yeah, fascinating. I didn't know that about you.
Yeah. Yeah, I used to work for the regulator in New Zealand.
Yes.
And I was a cartel price fixing specialist. Not too dissimilar to me, although I cannot say I have spent a lot of time working in Europe. I've traveled for work in Africa, but not been based there. And of course, you've had just about everywhere really that you've covered. A key theme in your career has been developing and implementing programs in a diverse range of geographies. What has your experience taught you are the most successful strategies to do this?
Wow, what a huge topic. We could talk about that for hours.
Yes, it's a series.
I'm glad you asked about this because I'm really passionate and excited about this. How do you take a well-designed global program and roll it out in such a way that it resonates locally and it can flex appropriately to local laws and cultures while still staying consistent to the required sort of overarching outcomes? And my biggest learnings here are not, I'm not going to go into the differences in ABAC laws and geography A, B, and C, or the pain and value of checking and double checking and triple checking translations, or understanding the difference between sort of red envelopes, white envelopes, or what happens in funerals in far-flung places. Although I would say the more that you can educate yourself, I think the better. These are all super important things. But my killer, if you want to call it that, is probably the simplest of all. And yet something that I think is often overlooked and does really take time and intentionality. And that's really building deep relationships based on trust and on connection. I heard somebody recently talk about connection more than trust.
Interesting. You
know, because I think connection is maybe a little bit more generous. We often in this dance of compliance can step on toes or can inadvertently do things. So I love that sort of piece about connection.
Yeah.
But I think it's only really when you are working with people that trust you that you hear the pain points, you hear really what happens with your processes or not, and you get a sense of what people are really pulling their hair out about, who key leaders are. And I just don't think there's any shortcuts to any of this.
Yeah.
But I think the unlock, if you can and invest the time, is just tremendous. I remember, I think this story maybe points to sometimes it's really small things that matter. I had been supporting a business which was a number of islands in the Indian Ocean between the east coast of Africa and the west coast of India, Sri Lanka. And in this business unit, beautiful place, very diverse culture by virtue of where they were, and this is seafaring roots, fiercely proud too of where they were. But in the business that I was in, they were lumped in with a particular regional geography. They were part of the regional business. And of course, everything that we did had the regional logo on it, which was the outline of the mainland continent. And it was really only through building a relationship with one of the finance team there that I realized that every time they saw this logo, the hackles would go up. Mm-hmm. It was incredibly distracting. Mm-hmm. So I took that on board, and I, in any of the materials or collateral, I just ditched that because it was problematic. Mm-hmm. And I altered my email signature block so that I'm dealing with folks in that particular location. I was giving prominence and honoring the fact that they were a geography of their own. And I cannot tell you the unlock and from doing something that small. They felt seen and heard and respected. I just think some of these really small things can make a huge difference, and you just don't get there if people don't trust you enough to share some of this.
Yes, I love that story. That's a wonderful success story and really speaks at the heart of what we do to become the true business enabler and facilitator of getting things done for our core business rather than being the police or the sheriff who always says no. I also love that comment about how connection could be even more important than trust. And what first came to mind for me was, you know, how like me bias is such a strong power. And it's not necessarily because the other person trusts you, it's because they see a bit of themselves in you. And I think that's one of the most potent energies that we have as human beings, is when you can get someone to see themselves in you, they will support you like almost nothing else in the world will make them do. But your point about trust is critical. And so perhaps the way I would look at it is, a lot of the time, a strong connection is necessary to get to the point of building trust. So without the connection, the ability to someone willing to give you the time of day, and a lot of that depends on whether you've managed to get the buy-in from connection, leads to whether you get the buy-in for trust. Wonderful. Thank you for those tips. That's very useful. And you could adapt that, dear listener, in so many different types of ways, right? Like the way in which you address your audience. So specifically calling out who's there. So a way in which we do this in the compliance space is, if you're in a hybrid conference setup, you never want to forget the people that are attending the conference virtually and only focus on the people in the room just because they're right in front of you. So a way in which I've done this with co-speakers before is make sure that there are prizes specifically dedicated for the virtual audience. Call them out. Make sure that you're checking the chat and giving people the recognition that they deserve in a more individualized basis.
Wow, love it.
Another topic that I wanted to talk about was an area where you're particularly strong. And again, it's critical for us in compliance. You are experienced in implementing transformational change. What do you think are the critical elements to put in place before you can be successful in transformational change?
Oh, wow. That's so generous. You know, change management. Wow. It's just such a broad discipline. And it's a discipline in itself.
Yes.
So I wouldn't presume to put myself alongside those real deep subject matter experts. But what I can share is things that I have found practically that have been super critical. Just appreciating how big the human factor is in change and really thinking intentionally about that and planning for it. Change can bring up so many emotions for people, particularly sort of anxiety. My approach to change management is always really to have that sort of human element up front and top of mind and engaging meaningfully with leaders, bringing them in early, enlisting them in the problem solving and option generation so that they can help co-create the solution and be really authentic when messaging and driving that sort of tone at the top that we often need to make change efforts really sustainable and have the impact. And I think it's also really about active listening as well. So I remember a situation where the organization I was in had an issue in the regulatory space, and I'm sure we've all faced those. We needed to remediate something very urgently across multiple jurisdictions. So a huge cross-functional team put together this excellent comprehensive plan, which we needed action very quickly. And we were engaging leaders on this, following our own advice, bringing them in early. And I began to see, this was during the sort of pandemic when we were all getting used to being on screens all day. I could see a leader in my PC who wasn't really saying an awful lot. And this was someone that I knew quite well, an important leader for the change that we were trying to drive. I'd spent many a Zoom call talking to him about his pandemic puppy. And it struck me as being really strange seeing his body language and just how quiet he was. So picking up the phone to him and having a sort of one-to-one offline to find out really what was on his mind or how was he feeling about the plans that we were putting in. And it was really in that sort of one-on-one conversation that after spending a lot of time talking about sort of detailed plan, he shared with me, or he said a few things that hinted at him being a little bit concerned about whether or not we as a team were working fast enough, and also what kind of risks did he face personally as a leader. And I remember the sort of the light bulb moments. Hallelujah. I can now see where the resistance is there. And knowing that we could work on it together, I could give him some comfort or additional detail on the balance that we were trying to achieve, working fast enough, but still being comprehensive in what we were doing. But he trusted me enough to share that information. And once we had it, of course, we can work with that. And his push, in actual fact, made us relook at whether there were areas that we could actually move faster on, knowing that we would get his total support and help him drive that. I love this story because I think it talks to the fact that to do anything, organizations, it's done by people, having them front of mind, creating the environment where people can open up candidly. I think you just get to much better solutions. And I think you have a far greater chance of affecting the change that you want and just creating trust along the way.
I love that. That reaction, I think, was perfect because a lot of people would have gone, what do you mean we're moving too slow? What would make you think that? We've never let you down before. And ultimately, go on the defensive. And one of the things that I've learned in compliance is that if anybody is raising an objection and there is veracity to it, you are much more credible when you agree with them. It's also really hard to argue with someone when you're both agreeing. The way in which you handled that person was really beautiful. It showed the respect for listening. And instead of the human nature angle of being affronted by what could have been taken as a criticism, instead you objectively thought on it and asked, could we level up here? Could we be doing better in this? Oh, actually we can. Cool, let's do that. So a great moment of reflection and maturity in terms of how you handled it.
Yeah, and I think that goes a long way to just building that trust. And now I kind of laugh with that individual, or I did. We have a phrase now, what's on your mind really? So yeah, it's all about people.
Yeah, that brings us really nicely to my next question for you, which is to talk about your strengths as a people manager. I happen to know for sure that you naturally command the respect, admiration, and loyalty of your team members. And I would love to do a shout out to your former team member at Molson Coors, Melissa. What a beautiful soul, very lovely woman and great woman in compliance. How would you describe your management style and approach to delivering constructive feedback to team members?
Yeah, look, just super kind of you to say this. And thank you so much. Melissa is just a tremendous individual and a huge credit to our space. I think being a people leader is probably one of the biggest challenges I've actually ever faced. I think being candid, I think it's a challenge if people are honest and if people are serious about it, for not just people in ethics and compliance, but just generally. And I always feel a bit strange when people say, what's your management style? Because my management style has really been influenced so much by the bosses and leaders that I've dealt with over the years. I feel tremendously lucky to have seen some really truly inspirational people. And sometimes these are people that I didn't report directly to. I had a fearless woman partner in Scotland with the sort of driest of humours who gave me probably the most direct feedback I had ever had in my life about getting out my comfort zone, not sleepwalking into a career and really seeking out roles and experiences that they might frighten the life out of me. That was really the only way I was going to grow. And I credit her for giving me the push to find roles that really fed into my passion. And I also had another really tremendous Israeli country manager who taught me something that I was really struggling with, and that was how to get really comfortable with and how to nurture really positive conflict. And I'm tremendously grateful to both them and a whole host of others that I don't have time to go into. But I think across all those leaders, the things that have really stood out to me is the fact that they care so deeply about the people that they work with. Yes, the product and what we do matters and needs to be, and we all want to have impact in the work that we do, but getting to know people, getting to know them beyond the sort of day-to-day work plan and showing up and caring, I think is such an antidote to the challenges, the overwhelm, the frustrations that everybody feels sort of day in, day out. So for me, I try and I aspire every single day to be that colleague and boss who really cares about people. And I think that helps then incredibly in almost not being able to sit on feedback. You care so much, you have to give it. And, you know, how that sort of caring shows up, I think, can differ. But I do remember working in an organization who'd had a tremendously traumatic incident occur, truly watershed moment for that organization. And yeah, being at the same time both bowled over by the professionalism that my team and the sensitivity and how they were moving heaven and earth to make sure that our plans were adjusted appropriately given everything the organization was going through. But at the same time, I was really and truly so worried about my team and just the emotional burden that they were going through. I couldn't solve any of these big, huge problems, but I could be there every single day to have a coffee or to just listen. And I think it's sometimes these really small things that people remember years down the track.
Yeah.
So for me, that's key. And I feel I've worked with some sort of tremendous colleagues who have made that just a pure pleasure.
Wonderful. This is possibly a conversation for another day, but I am dying to hear some tips on how to nurture healthy conflict. My goodness. What I was hearing from you that might be an idea for a side hustle in the future or even now is, you know, the clearly what that earlier manager got you thinking about in terms of taking roles that would really stretch you and advance you. When you were first telling us about all the places you've worked, and I thought, darn it, Elaine has had all of these great big names and I'm missing that on my own resume, right? Like it's something that I'm quite conscious of. I'd love to have a Molson Coors type brand on there. And that's, I think, a gap for me. And so it would be amazing for you to be a coach that helps ethics and compliance professionals strategize, not even necessarily in the job search, but in the career mapping as well, of how do I identify the right role of where I want to be? And now how am I going to get there? What are the things to do? So just putting that out there as a little business plan for the future.
And Mary, that would be such a sort of honor. I've had so many people in my career that have sent the elevator down to me. I'm incredibly lucky. I feel really privileged.
Also gold star for that reference. This conversation has gone so fast. We're at the last question now, which is diplomacy in the workplace is something that all of us must continuously work on in order to be successful. And maybe nurturing healthy conflict is a part of that. It can be particularly challenging dealing with difficult individuals, especially those I find who are in a position of power over us. Although I would say that dealing with difficult individuals is never pleasant or something that I would look for anyway. But when they somehow have won over us, if you will, then that's particularly challenging. So I'd love to hear about what would your advice be for our listeners who are in a situation where they have a fractious relationship with someone more senior or otherwise more powerful than them at work?
Oh, wow. These questions, Mary, they're incredible. And yes, 24-year career, I have definitely had my fair share of fractious relationships and sleepless nights. And I think part and parcel of it really is your mind. I think if you want to be in ethics and compliance, it's just part and parcel of what we do.
Yes.
Many of us, I think, will have been in situations where there's just this inherent tension. It could be balancing the relationship with your CEO and your audit chair. one business leader, you know, is desires and needs over another. Just the very fact that by the very nature of what we do, we are often the messengers of the worst possible news to leaders who already have so much on their plate. And then I think there's this sort of personal tension too, being immensely proud for the little wins that you get on the board for your program. But then that, I think, deep-seated, somebody referred to it as relentlessly dissatisfied, but that piece around... Yeah. Never, there's never really a finish line in compliance. There's always more to do.
Yeah.
I think, I'm not sure I have the magic answers to these questions, but just getting my head around the fact that this is the name of the game in our space. I want to be a bit provocative and say diplomacy. I've really evolved my thinking in diplomacy. Coming from that sort of buttoned up sort of British mentality, I always thought diplomacy was truly critical to success. But I had a really funny sort of light bulb moment when I was in Australia, and I was sitting having a coffee with my country leader. And he was a very accomplished individual. And I think he spoke about 7 or 8 languages. Mm. And I was maybe speaking to him in language, I don't know, 4 or 5. And he was mentioning this meme, this dreadful name meme that he had seen, which was essentially, it's a joke, but it's person A says something, person B hears something else, blah, 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 blah. And it might go along the lines of something like, person from country A says, I've got this idea, and explains what it is. Person B from another country says, that's very interesting. And person A hears, wow, they love my idea.
Yeah, well, yes.
I'm off to the races, off I go. And really what person B was meaning is, this is doomed. Yes. I am going to be distancing myself. So
yes,
I have, as I say, evolved my thinking on diplomacy. And just speaking to this individual who is talking in his 3rd or 4th language, I think a lot can go wrong. Trying to be diplomatic. Yes. And there's so many cultural pieces to it. For sure, you're not going to advance your program if you call out your key leader in a town hall.
Exactly.
But I think professionalism and straightforwardness and clarity have actually probably served me better. I can remember having a conversation with a very senior leader, and I was trying to get across the point that our helpline numbers weren't really what they could be, and why I needed his help on a sort of speak up campaign and how we might go about this. And I could tell that the way that I had positioned this with this leader, who was super accomplished but new in this particular leadership role, I could just see the color drain out his face. He basically said to me, look, I'm new in this role, and I've got problems coming at me from every which way. And you're telling me that what I need to do is look for more problems?
Yeah.
So being diplomatic just really, I think, can totally backfire. And particularly for experienced leaders who are time poor, working in a sort of fast-paced environment with so many things hitting them at once, sometimes just cutting to the chase, I think, can really pay dividends. Done politely and done with respect and without drama and emotion. But yeah, I've revised my thinking on diplomacy. For what it's worth, I would always sort of maybe think twice or just use a little bit of caution, particularly in a cultural context.
Yeah, I think that's so important. We've raised this topic before, you know, your point about the direct communication. Donna Schneider's Crucial Conversations episode was one where I shared that the New Zealand culture is very direct in terms of what we say, but we really care about respect and dignity of the other person when we get across the message. And in the United States, I don't know if you found this, Elaine, but I find that there's a lot of beating around the bush, dancing around the issue. We'll do everything that we can to not call out something that really needs to be called out. And then, because nothing ever changes, because we haven't communicated anything, we're just going to resent that person who's doing that thing that we don't like. And that drives me bonkers. I hope I haven't lost our entire United States audience, folks.
And you'll know I'm not responding to that. It would be undiplomatic.
And I don't mean for it to be rude at all. America's got many good things going for it. I do enjoy Hollywood movies, junk food, all of the other things that you bring to the Four Team USA. But I would say that it could be worth a shot trying something. And there are various ways in which you can try this. So sometimes I just say to people, I'm from New Zealand and we're very direct. So I'm just going to come right out and say it. Or with an individual recently, I said, I've got some feedback to share. And they'd actually solicited the feedback. So again, feedback given with permission. So ask people for permission first, because people have to be in the right mindset to receive feedback. And if you've caught them in a bad time, no matter how valid your feedback is, it's not going to be well received. So this happen to have been solicited. But my tip for you is to ask for permission to share feedback. Allow people to open that door. And I said to him, I'm going to be fairly straightforward with some of these things because I really like you and I want you to be successful. And another is, and I share this tip in my upcoming book, which is on ways to level up and innovate on your compliance program, is try using the words, I know that this was not the news you were hoping to hear. Because that really sets up the person for being in a position to receive that feedback. And there's really lovely sort of neuroscience approaches to why this can work from Penny Milner-Smythe, GWIC alum, who shares her thought leadership in the book alongside that technique as well. I think a lot of things said with love can be a really great way forward. And I'm not asking you to not be yourself and not communicate authentically. But if there's something that you're really dying to get out, and to Elaine's point, that you're only really holding back because you feel it would be for diplomatic reasons not to, there are ways to preserve relationships and still get what you need.
Absolutely. And look, Mary, I haven't answered your sort of last question, which I think is something that we all struggle with. What do you do when you have that difficult relationship? And again, I don't think that this is rocket science. For me, I think leaning in with curiosity. If I think back to the story about my sort of business leader who was very quiet and I could just tell that they weren't on board. Mm-hmm. I think leaning in, just trying not to take it personally, leaning in and finding out what's really behind it can really open up a number of options that you just may not have thought about. And then perspective. This is a marathon, but it's not a sprint. Mm-hmm. Taking time away, thinking about other things, getting your head in the right space. Mm-hmm. Maybe you'll have sort of one of those in the shower moments where you go, now I think I see what I'm missing. And building also your network, be it internal, external. Everyone needs a cheer squad, but I think they also need they need the others too, the ones that will tell it to them straight and give them the sort of pep talk. You don't need to divulge confidential information to just problem solve some of these things with individuals who might just give you enough to get that problem solved.
Wonderful. Thank you, Elaine, so much for your time today. It's a privilege to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you so much. And great to be here. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Great Women in Compliance. We hope you'll join us in honoring the great women in the compliance field by subscribing to this podcast and leaving a review.